Welcome to the Washington AI Network podcast. I'm Tammy Haddad, the founder of the Washington AI Network, where we bring together official Washington policymakers, DC insiders, and AI experts who are challenging, debating, and just trying to figure out the rules of the road for artificial intelligence. Joining me on today's podcast is Kent Walker, the president of global affairs for Alphabet and Google. Walker has been working with technologists and governments around the world, overseeing policy matters. Kent, I'm so glad to talk to you today. There's no company and probably no person who spent more time on the policy issues surrounding AI. Thank you for joining us.
Tammy, it's a real pleasure to be with you today.
Thank you. I want to get your guidance on the White House request for comments regarding its AI action plan. I'm eager to hear your recommendations, but first, let's take a step back. After all, it was Google that started this whole AI race in motion. So was it Google Translate or AlphaFold? Take us back because you were right there through all of it.
Yeah, it's been fascinating. People don't realize they've been using AI for 15 years. If they've been using Google Search or Maps or Translate or even Gmail, you've been benefiting from AI. It's just that it was making things better behind the curtain, and now it's stepped out into the main stage. And so in 2016, I think, we said we were going to be an AI-first company. We started putting out papers that laid the groundwork for a lot of this generative AI work that you're seeing now. And that transformation has been fascinating. We are really seeing now breakthroughs in science that are astonishing. People forget AI is not just a scientific breakthrough. It's a breakthrough in how we make breakthroughs. So it's easy to get focused on the chatbot side of this. Chatbots are 5% of the potential of AI. As we go through and we see things like AlphaFold, which is this remarkable breakthrough in medical science.
Can you drill down on AlphaFold? Because I think it's the lead in saving lives. In fact, I just talked to Senator Rounds, and he thinks that cancer will be gone in 5 years because of AlphaFold.
We're laying the foundations for those kinds of incredible breakthroughs. So let me take you back. Maybe 20, 25 years ago, we sequenced human DNA, and that was great. But just knowing the sequence of letters didn't lead to breakthroughs in coming up with new kinds of medicine, because you had to know how those individual proteins folded. Different vaccines would work with different viruses and the like. And folding those proteins turned out to be a huge task. There are 200 million human proteins out there in your body. And each one of those proteins would take a biology PhD student a full thesis, 3 or 4 years, just to fold one protein. The team at AlphaFold figured out how to use AI to fold all 200 million of them and did it over the course of a couple of months and then released that to the world. So now we have more than 2 million researchers around the world working on new kinds of medicine. We're going to have new AI-generated medicines coming to clinical trials by the end of this year. It's an incredibly exciting time, and that lays the foundation for the kind of breakthroughs that Senator Rounds is talking about.
And also, you have put all this information out. I guess people call it open source now, right? With AlphaFold.
Yeah. So we have published a lot of the work we are doing here and continue to try and share information. We want to do it carefully. We want to do it responsibly, because the same things that can be used for these kinds of technologies also could be abused. So we consulted with bioethicists and researchers before we actually went down the path here. But so far, the results have been remarkable.
One other note on Google in the larger picture, and that is that you have scientists, you have technologists, not just product people. They're there too, obviously. So it's almost like a government because it's research labs.
Roughly half of the employees at Google are engineers. In some ways, we are the nerdiest of the tech companies. And there's nothing that gets our engineers more excited than the potential for these kinds of remarkable scientific breakthroughs, not just in healthcare, as we've talked about, but material science. We have a project called Genome that has created hundreds of thousands of new materials, thousands of which may be really practically useful in things like coming up with batteries that have much more capacity or materials of much lighter weight for cars and planes. So as we see that go down the list, healthcare, material science, quantum breakthroughs that we're starting to see faster and faster, the potential to bring clean water to people around the world, energy, research in small modular reactors and fusion. Just a few years ago, people were saying it was harder and harder to find new ideas in science. Now it's getting easier and easier. It's a remarkable time.
Well, it's interesting, too. I feel like AI, in a way, has made science more relatable to people as well. And they see that, okay, this is going to change the world. And ChatGPT and Google with Gemini and everything, the same kind of thing, where you have more context and more information right at your fingertips. You don't have to be getting a PhD at MIT to learn about AlphaFold.
It's a key insight, because we are seeing progress in two directions at once. We now have the most advanced models in the world that are at or above human PhD level. That's the path to helping cure cancer and making all these other breakthroughs. And at the same time, the costs of these models have come down remarkably. In the course of the last 2 years, we are 300 times more efficient per dollar spent. That makes these tools more and more available to everybody. So your phone now will have some of the same power that was on a supercomputer just a few years ago. It's a remarkable pace of change. Making those tools available to everybody in their everyday lives to simplify the work they're doing, to streamline things, to make it easier for them to order a burger at Wendy's or talk to their car. Or Home Depot has a new tool called Magic Apron, where you can call in and basically get home improvement guidance that's tailored to whatever project you're working on. So I think this is really going to have dramatic benefits for people in their everyday lives, in addition to the scientific changes.
So we have the new Trump administration, and the first Trump administration started some of these committees, NIAC, et cetera, to bring people together to talk about not just national security issues, but the issues around AI. They're back in. They pushed aside the Biden EO, and they've come to you and others and said, hey, we're going to have a new AI action plan. What are your recommendations?
So Michael Kratsios was in the first Trump administration and of the Office of Science and Technology Policy, OSTP, and was involved in the first Trump EO around AI, and then has since spent time working in the private sector and is now back as the head of OSTP. And he and others working on this plan are very much focused on a pro-innovation agenda. Our contributions have been to focus on the need for investment. There's a huge amount of private sector investment already going on, but we also need to have more investment in energy, streamlining, permitting reform, that kind of work. Mm-hmm. We also want to encourage them to streamline, to modernize government AI adoption. You've recently seen some new procurement regulations coming out that aim to encourage the federal government in the U.S. to do more to adopt that.
Yeah, I want to follow up on that, because one of the ways that I think the word about AI comes out is when government starts using it, not just the U.S. government, but governments around the world. But boy, changing things in any government is very difficult. So are there specific things that you think will work?
Sure. We're very enthusiastic about the possibilities here. We've actually set up a team called Google Public Sector that is devoted to exactly these kinds of things, whether that's helping avoid fraud in the distribution of government benefits or streamlining the work of the Department of Motor Vehicles, right? One of the most challenging interactions that most Americans have with their government is going through the DMV. Can we make that a little bit easier? Can we, behind the scenes, allow governments to take advantage of all the data sets they already have to look for trends and get ahead of the curve? We are certainly seeing other countries do this. I mean, China, from the top down, you know, Xi Jinping has basically put a directive out that China should adopt AI quickly. And there are published reports out there. There are 200,000 new AI companies in China. You've read about DeepSeek. There's a cutting-edge model that came out recently. Something like 600 million Chinese are already working with large language models. So the United States needs to pick up the pace to stay in the game here.
Should there be education, K-12 education?
Look, I think it's going to change our education system in different ways, right? Your kids are already using various AI tools. The notion of sending home a homework assignment where you're writing an essay and bringing it back probably doesn't work quite as well anymore. You have to rethink, you know, how do you comment on the answer that you got from the AI tool? But the positive news is, imagine now every kid has their own personalized tutor who can answer their questions about any topic. It's a supercharger, it's a turbocharger for being able to research any area you're interested in. One of my favorite tools we've created is called Notebook LM. And if you haven't tried it, I recommend it.
Oh, yeah. It's great.
It will pull together sources for you. We just announced last week, you can upload your own sources, but now it will find sources for you. And you can use that to then mine and go deeper about individual areas. It'll even create podcasts if you want a 10-minute summary of these things.
I know. I feel like I'm being replaced. It's so fascinating that all of this is coming at the same time, and just the volume and how to engage people. And literally, I looked at the announcements that you guys made at your Cloud Next conference this week. There's like four announcements that I could spend an hour talking to you about. But let's go back to the opportunity that you think that the federal government has, and also the states, because I think it's like 700 different pieces of legislation in all the states. I mean, what's your recommendation on how to get the country to work together?
It's a critical point, because we need to avoid a patchwork of inconsistent laws. I don't think anybody wants that. We are hoping that we are seeing more focus on the innovation agenda, the notion of trying to have standards-based compliance on these things, as we've seen in lots of other sectors, right? We have standards from the International Standards Organization in the United States. You have everything from the Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval to Underwriters Laboratory for, you know, make sure your toaster isn't going to blow up fuse. So those kinds of frameworks are starting to evolve. We really need a shared definition of what does good look like and what does bad look like in these spaces. And once you have that, it actually makes it easier for the innovators to evaluate the quality of their models, and it creates sort of a shared language that works across companies, across sectors, and even across countries.
Do you think that all the different laws and rules and considerations are hurting innovation now, or is that something in the future?
We're watching initiatives like the European AI Act and the Code of Practice carefully. There are a number of different countries that are looking at different aspects of this. And as you say, there are lots of different state laws out there. Our job is to really advocate for consistency and alignment. There is a role for regulation with regard to national security issues and transparency. We recently endorsed the No Fakes Act in Washington to avoid misleading representation of things that are taking people's likenesses and passing them off, but doing that in a balanced way so it respects the rights of individual creators, but also the needs of platforms and the need for this technology to keep developing in ways that are helpful for everybody.
Don't you feel like universal standards, though, are going to be basic if you want the startups to have an equal opportunity?
Yeah. So having that clarity at this moment is really critical. There's an old line in technology regulation called Coleridge's Dilemma. This comes from a book from the 1980s. And the dilemma is this, that when you have a new technology, it's possible to regulate too late once it's baked in, but also possible to regulate too early before you really know the potential of the technology and you're going to get it by the wrong end. So the sweet spot there, especially with the technology that's evolving so quickly, again, you know, 300 times improvement in the last 2 years is astonishing, is to really focus on the individual use cases, the specific real-world impacts. We say regulate the outputs, not the inputs. Don't micromanage the science. Focus on the potential harms that you're trying to avoid and how do you create guardrails to avoid those.
Okay, DeepSeek, it hit like a rocket all around the world. Were you surprised by that?
I think DeepSeek is the most advanced model we've seen out of China. It's a nice piece of engineering. I think there was a little bit of market overreaction at the time. People didn't appreciate that a lot of the models we were already putting out were already as efficient or more efficient in different ways. And so we are making sure that we are doing everything we can to stay ahead in this race. I will say that, you know, we thought that we might be a couple of years in the lead, and now we think we're a few months in the lead.
Do you have some sort of calendar? There should be some sort of, I don't know, like sometimes it's a thermometer, right, in offices or something that say, we're this far ahead, we're that far ahead. Do you have something on the wall that you move up and down?
Well, the industry has a version of that. There's the various ranking systems that you can put out there, with, you know, chess player rankings to decide which model's in the lead. We're pleased at the moment our models are in the lead on a lot of those leaderboards. It's constantly moving. It's a very dynamic space. And you've seen so many different breakthroughs, not just more compute, but things like agentic reasoning, chain of thought reasoning, mixtures of experts, multimodality, meaning having, you know, audio and video as well as text all coming together, long context where you can actually upload huge amounts of information, something like, you know, the entire Harry Potter series, and then ask any question about something that happened anywhere in those books. So, you know, imagine that, but now for the U.S. tax code or for, you know, all of your retail records to understand where people are buying which kinds of goods and services. So the tools are becoming really much more powerful.
Yeah, that's really exciting. I went to SNL and went to the after party, which I waited many years to be invited to the after party, Ken.
Very cool.
And I get there and I walk in and the first person I see is someone from my AI network. It was working with Lauren Michaels. Okay. And creating avatars. So it made me think, wait, are there going to be comedians? And, you know, I worked on Veep and other shows, and the comedy writers tell me that AI can't make you funny. I guess we'll find out about that. But the idea that you could have an avatar for your CEO, I mean, you're right when you talk about a professor or a tutor, but the kind of communication that you could accomplish more quickly when it's just avatars.
Our YouTube team is already working with lots of artists and creators who are going back to their own material and using it as a creative tool to come up with new songs, new riffs on the work they've done. It's really an exciting time to be a creator using these new tools. It's like when electronic music first came out, the new sounds, the new creativity is really exciting to see.
I wonder if you do any kind of surveys. Is it younger people or older people, or who's adopting AI first? Do you look at that at all?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, the natural trend is that the younger folks tend to pick up first, but because these tools are so easy to learn,
right?
It's not necessarily something, you know, you don't have to learn how to do computer coding. In fact, you can have these tools build you a website without knowing how to code.
Yeah.
So it is a leveler in many ways. This is the only tool I've ever seen that teaches you how to use the tool.
Right.
A hammer doesn't tell you how to hit a nail, but you can ask an AI model how to ask better prompts. If I'm a financial analyst, if I'm a marketing person, if I'm trying to run my small store, how can I ask prompts that give me interesting information? And actually raises the level of the least skilled people the most.
Right.
So it's a great access point.
That's so funny you should say that, because I was telling someone this morning, I want to have a prompt party so people can come in and talk about their favorite prompts, their most successful prompts, because that's really the game. And you're right, anyone could do it. All right, but I got to get you to national security, because we're here in Washington. Google now is involved with the Defense Department and national security issues. That's a change from 10 years ago or 5 years ago. How do you look at these national security issues? Because they are going to be an important part of this AI action plan.
No question. To be clear, Google has been working with DOD and national security since the beginning of the company. Some of the first products we sold were actually search engines in a box, in this big yellow pizza box, we used to call them, which were embedded search engines that you can use to search your own data. And we did a lot of that with the national government and DOD. So your larger point is totally right. We can't afford not to invest in security. We're seeing cyber attacks that are something like $10 trillion a year. So for a lot of years now, Google has focused on this problem. We like to say we keep more people safe than anyone else in the world because, you know, our websites are attacked, et cetera. But if people using Gmail, we're not getting spam. We're not getting malware. When you're using Chrome and you're not going to a site that's infected to malware, that's because we're using our security by design tools in the background. Mm-hmm. So we've also been using AI to accelerate those efforts for more than a dozen years. We've been using machine learning to detect hackers who might be trying to get into our networks. And so the good news is that AI is giving the advantage back to the defenders in some way. We can use these tools to survey our networks and other people's networks and understand where their vulnerabilities and patch them before the bad guys have a chance to take advantage of them. We're seeing this in the wild already. Just last fall, we had our deep sleep agent go out and find the first public example of what's called a zero-day attack, an attack that's never been found before in the wild. And we detected it and were able to warn people about it so system administrators could patch the bug. Mm-hmm. So we all need to work together on this across the industry with government. Obviously, government has, you know, secure classified information that's valuable to make sure our models are not being used or misused in bad ways. And the more we can have a public-private collaboration on cyber defense, the better for everybody.
Right. I guess that's the key, because you've got private industry that's so far ahead of government, but you need government and they need you to keep everyone safe.
No question.
Because this is just another level. You know, what was that movie? Everything, Every Day, Everywhere, or whatever it was called.
Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, I think. Yeah.
Right, right. But at first, the idea, I think, here was, oh my God, industry is ahead. And this is a little scary of government. And now in DC, it's been an interesting change. Hey, it's fantastic that industry is ahead. We can go to them and ask them to look deeper in this part of an issue or that part of an issue. And we can keep America safer, because I'm talking about the federal government, right? When you're competing with Chinese and other enemies.
I think it's exactly right. And look, the great thing here is largely this is private sector investment. We're not looking for taxpayer handouts. We do need to have a framework that encourages innovation and that the federal government, particularly the national security side of the house, has a lot of unique expertise. And so how do we find a way to work together collaboratively there and to make sure we've got, you know, appropriate guardrails against misuse? The standard setting becomes so important because not just the U.S. government, this is a global phenomenon. Right. And as we talked about a little bit before, a patchwork of laws around the world doesn't help anybody. So the more industry can help, as we have with the International Standards Organization, there's a group called Frontier Model Forum, there are other ML Commons that are all working on this notion of how do you define a standardized set of what are appropriate processes and reviews. That helps the whole industry evolve.
Mm-hmm. And what about like OECD? I mean, are they stepping in?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of good work here. You've seen the G7 created its Hiroshima process, which has been a very thoughtful approach that, you know, key principles. That work has then been taken forward by the OECD to sort of expand the net a little bit. And now there's an OECD plus process to bring in even more countries because countries outside the OECD, particularly in the developing world, are really excited about the possibilities here. And they want to have a seat at the table. James Manyika from Google co-chaired a UN session on frameworks for AI development. So at almost every level, we're seeing a lot of interest. And the challenge is to kind of get alignments, to herd the cats, to make sure that everybody is more or less converging on a common notion of what good standards are.
Well, it seems like you've got everyone's attention on that. So that's a good thing. All right, we have to talk about agentic AI because it's going to change everything, and it is changing everything. You guys are already using it, right?
Yeah.
What do you think people don't know about it or how it will help them?
I think that's the key. Thinking of agent in the abstract is kind of unhelpful. But if you think about how it makes your life easier, that little things that you otherwise would have had to hassle with that just happen automatically now, that's really the key. So from a business level, we're looking at all sorts of new ways of increased productivity, making coding easier. For example, Google already, we're doing more than 25% of our coding by AI agents and reviewed by humans. That's oftentimes the coding that was just the administrative side of things. Our teams can now more or less automate. But beyond that, we talked about cybersecurity a moment ago, retail kinds of work, customer support. You know, we're all used to going through those awful old phone trees and, you know, press two and not really getting the answer you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
What if anytime day or night, you could call in and get an AI agent that had all the knowledge and all the expertise of every customer service representative who had ever worked for that firm, who had memorized every user manual, et cetera, and be able to give you just the information you wanted right when you wanted it. That's the promise of agents.
What about the privacy and security issues around agentic? Because I keep thinking about, oh, I'm going to give AI my credit card. Okay, I know they already have my credit card. You guys already have my credit card. Everybody has my credit card. But it's you don't have my kid's social security number and that credit card.
Now, establishing a trusted relationship here is going to be very important. Nobody wants to ask their AI agent to order a pizza and find a million pizzas delivered to their house by accident. So how do we put in safeguards so that there's oversight, you know, authorization before your credit card is used, et cetera? I think that's an important part of the user interface as we build it out. Now, of course, the more information the system has, the more it can customize and know that, you know, you don't like anchovies or whatever else would be to streamline some of that work. But I think it's going to be a sort of trust building exercise as people get more and more comfortable using these tools in new ways.
Mm-hmm. It's like maps. I remember when you guys rolled out maps and people are like, maps? Why would I need a map on my phone? And now no one goes anywhere without maps.
I'm old enough to remember when we had, you know, thick map book in the back of the car and you'd have to flip through to figure out where you were. They say now two experiences that kids will never have. They'll never be bored and they'll never be lost.
Oh my God, that's great. That's really funny.
And Google Maps has actually turned out to be a remarkably powerful tool, which is, in a funny way, it's a different way of searching. Right. Instead of a text-based way of searching, it's a spatial way of searching. So it was something that we've been really pleased with, and a lot of people have found a lot of value in.
Oh, we like it. Okay. So the DOJ has had this case against you guys, a search distribution lawsuit. I know you're appealing the court's decision, and the process requires that you first file some proposed remedies. What have you proposed? And do you worry about having to split Chrome off from the company? And all my information's on Google Docs, so this is a personal issue for me.
So look, we very much want to keep your information safe and secure. And we think that having the ability to have security learnings across our services has been great for the people who use our services. So splitting off parts of the company doesn't really relate to any of the allegations in the core case. So we don't think it makes sense. We don't think the court will go there. And look, we do believe that, generally speaking, it's a good thing for Google to be able to make our services as broadly available to people as possible, including having partnerships with companies like Mozilla or Apple or Samsung to make Google tools and services easily accessible. So you will see how that plays out in the court. Our remedies that we proposed are much more focused on the actual issues in the case. What kinds of distribution contracts are acceptable? Which ones are not acceptable? We'll have a hearing in the next few weeks, and we'll see where the court comes out probably over the next few months.
Okay, let's turn to quantum, because you're quantum leaders. Is that going to wipe away coding and everything else? And does that make us safer or less safe?
Quantum is an incredibly exciting area. We have had a series of breakthroughs there, and we think we're on course to have practical quantum computing by the end of this decade. That's been a long-sought goal, but I think we're getting very close. The leader of our quantum team describes quantum as the language of nature. It's how atoms talk to each other in this probabilistic state. For listeners who may not follow this, quantum basically moves from the old binary of ones and zeros to every state simultaneously. And so it dramatically increases the power of computational tools. So AI and quantum working together, you can see AI maybe facilitating quantum then turbocharging AI in exchange. But there's a lot of deep science, a lot of deep research that still needs to be done. These qubits, they're called, that you string together, have to be incredibly dark and incredibly cold.
Wow.
We joke that Santa Barbara, California, where we do this research, is the coldest place in the universe.
Wow.
Because it has to be within a tiny fraction of absolute zero. But the breakthroughs we're seeing there are remarkable, and we're on track, I think, to continue to have more.
And that's why energy is even more important now, right? Because it's got to be so cold. So it's not just the data centers, it's for quantum.
Refrigeration turns out to be an important technology in this area to make sure you're keeping everything as cold as it can be. We do hope that quantum then will open up new paths for material science. If you understand how atoms communicate, you understand at a deeper level what new materials will be useful. There are challenges as well. There's something called quantum decryption, which could actually allow bad guys to decrypt a lot of encrypted material we have now. So we're also working on quantum encryption to stay ahead of that. There's quantum communication. There's a lot of really interesting work here at the very edges of science.
I hear the White House is focused on that too, right? For these action plans.
Yeah, I think it's a national security priority, obviously, if only because of the encryption-decryption issue, but also for these other sort of scientific breakthroughs. The leadership in technology is fundamental, I think, to geopolitical leadership. If you look at the what was called the long century between the late 1700s and the early 1900s, Britain led the world because they led in steam and coal. In the beginning of the 20th century, America led the world because we led in mass production and material science. The question now is, who's going to lead in the 21st century? And there's cause for concern. The Australian Strategic Policy Institute, ASPI, puts out a review every couple of years of which countries are leading in various critical technologies, from batteries to chemistry to energy, you name it. Around 2000, the United States led in 60 of 64 categories. Today, China leads in 57 of those 64 categories.
Wow.
So that's a real wake-up call to the United States. So we need to make sure we are doubling down our investments in all these cutting-edge areas.
Kent, I can't thank you enough for your time today. I really appreciate it. I appreciate your enthusiasm and excitement and the work you're doing to help Washington and the rest of the world figure all this out.
Thank you, Tammy. It couldn't be more important. It's been a pleasure to be with you today.
Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.